my own research of my collaborations with Henrietta and Daniel Friedman that I've been working on, and I'll try to focus on the part that can be easily understood with the introduction I'm giving before. So let me first motivate the subject. And so in textbook, when you open a textbook and you're trying to read about quantum field theory, the first thing that you see is a Lagrangian. And if you want to calculate scattering amplitudes, they instruct you to use Feynman rules. And you do your Feynman graph calculations, you sum everything up, and you get your amplitude. And of course, most quantum field theory books start with scalars because those have the simplest Feynman rules, and you easily succeed in calculating your first quantum field theory amplitude. Now, of course, half of quantum field theory books are usually talking about other stuff, because once you try to start adding gauge fields, things become more complicated. So that can be vector fields or gravity. Things get even more complicated, because you have a redundancy in the Lagrangian description, which is simply a gauge symmetry, is nothing but a redundancy in the description. So you end up having unphysical degrees of freedom. And if you try to get rid of these unphysical degrees of freedom, so you do a gauge fixing procedure, you add ghosts. And so you, your calculation of amplitudes gets a lot more complicated. You have to add those ghost field propagators and vertices and so on and so forth. So scattering amplitudes, as I just said, are computed using Feynman diagrams. And when you have a gauge symmetry, there are many vertices and many diagrams. But each diagram by itself doesn't have a well-defined physical interpretation. Each diagram is gauge-dependent and thus unphysical. And only the final result for on-shell amplitudes has a physical meaning. And surprisingly, you find after adding all of your complicated unphysical contributions that sometimes these things sum up into very simple expressions. So you're wondering, maybe I'm not doing this quite right. I'm doing this long calculation. At the end, the result is ridiculously simple. And another disadvantage with this quantum textbook approach is that once you add supersymmetry, things become more complicated, because at least naively, because you have more fields, you have to add more vertices. And for example, if you're trying to do some calculation, some loop calculation in the in the field theory that has the highest supersymmetry in four dimensions, which is n equals a supergravity, you end up with an incredible number of terms, because each vertex by itself has around 100 terms. And then when you do a loop calculation, you have lots of these vertices. So for example, this is just some stupid estimation, but at a five loop level, you could easily have an order of 10 to the 30 number of terms that you have to add before you get your final result. So, and this is sort of counterintuitive, because I mean, supersymmetry in general should help us. It's a symmetry, it should make life easier, but it makes life harder. So let me now define the scope of this talk, and it'll be a disappointment for you in the beginning, because I'm going to talk about tree amplitudes. I'm going to talk about gauge theory. So why would I want to do that? Why would I want to talk about tree amplitudes? Loop amplitudes are so much more interesting. Well, actually, they help you. Tree amplitudes are basic ingredients in doing loop calculations these days. And the idea is that you're doing your loop calculations by cutting tree amplitudes in appropriate ways, so that after cutting internal propagators, you end up with blobs of tree amplitudes, like I've given a one loop example here and I guess four loop example over there. So actually, to do efficient loop calculations, it's very helpful to understand tree amplitudes very well and to compute them efficiently. Now, and why gauge theory? Gravity is so much more interesting, right? Well, so there's a couple of motivations. One is for QCD. QCD is still the amplitudes at in QCD are still not very well understood. If you go to higher loop order, especially the bottleneck is, I guess, next to leading or next to leading order, depending on the amplitude that you're calculating. And we need to understand this very well to see physics beyond the standard model at the LHC, because to see a signal for new physics, you have to understand your background very well. The other thing is that a particularly interesting gauge theory is n equals 4 super Young Mills. I mean, it has appeared before today. In Yuji's talk, he's given a nice little introduction about n equals 4 super Young Mills. And it plays a prominent role in the ADC ADS-CFT correspondence. And the third interest in loop in gauge theory amplitude comes actually from gravity. And that is, again, like we have seen, an application of string theory, where actually string theory gives us a result on, or motivates a result on pure quantum field theory, which tells us that gravity amplitudes are related to gauge theory amplitudes. And in some way, the gravity amplitudes are simply the squares of appropriate gauge theory amplitudes. So these are the so-called KLT relations. I mean, I'm oversimplifying here. There are some prefactors here, and you have to sum over permutations of legs. But I mean, morally, this is how you can calculate gravity amplitudes, and this is often how it is done. The gravity amplitude is simply can be calculated directly from the gauge theory amplitudes. And that works, for example, you can calculate pure Einstein gravity amplitudes from pure Young-Mills amplitudes, basically from QCD amplitudes. And similarly, n equals 8 supergravity amplitudes can be calculated from n equals 4 super Young-Mills amplitudes. And that one is particularly interesting because people are suspecting that this theory might actually be the only four-dimensional gravity theory that is perturbatively finite. And any questions about my motivation so far? Please feel free to interrupt me at any time. OK, so let me talk about on-shell methods. How do we tackle this problem more efficiently? So let me make two slides about technical preliminaries. But these technical preliminaries are actually going to simplify our life and not make it harder. So don't be too scared of technicalities. One thing is, as you may know, when you have an on-shell null momenta, that means the momenta of a massless on-shell particle, then you can associate spinners with that. I mean, those are basically solutions to the Dirac equation, or as it's massless, to the Weyl equation. And I'll just abbreviate these two-dimensional spinners, Weyl spinners, with angle brackets and square brackets, respectively, so that we get rid of all the indices on the future slides. And we can also go the other way around. So by the way, I want to emphasize that if you have real momenta, which you usually do, at least in your usual applications, these two are related by morally by complex conjugation. So they are not really independent. But once you actually, what we will do, we will be interested in complex momenta also, and then we will treat them as independent variables. And we can go the other way around. We can reconstruct a massless momentum from given such a spinner. And the idea is simply that this is basically a dyadic product of these two spinners. And in this formalism, the mass of the momentum, basically the momentum squared, is simply the determinant of this 2 by 2 matrix. And as this is, I mean, as I'm building this matrix out of two vectors, it's clear that it is rank 1. And as it's a 2 by 2 matrix, its determinant must be 0. So this is why this is a massless. This corresponds to a massless vector. And similarly, if you have two different vectors and you want to compute their inner product, you can also do this simply in this notation. And so just to mention some properties of these spinners. Well, one is basically the Dirac equation, that they are annihilated by the momentum if it's written in this way. And then the spinner products, these inner products, are anti-symmetric. In particular, if you take an inner product of a spinner with itself, it simply vanishes. This is, of course, similarly true for the square brackets, not just for these angle brackets. Another interesting identity that is very useful is the Skouten identity, which basically says that this inner product, this here, is a number times a two-dimensional spinner. If you add, and they correspond to three different momenta, if you add them cyclically, this is simply 0. And so the basic idea behind this identity is if you have three different two-dimensional vectors, they can't be, or well, spinners, two-dimensional spinners, they can't be independent, linearly independent. So there's a relation between them, and the Skouten identity is simply the relation between these two spinners. The second technicality is that we're going to simplify our life. We want to get rid completely of the gauge group of our gauge theory. So that means we're looking at amplitudes where we drop the trace of the gauge theory generators. So, and then at the end, we simply have an up. So the idea is that the whole amplitude is simply these basic amplitudes, these colors, color stripped amplitudes, and then multiplied by the appropriate traces. And what I've dropped here are permutations of these external lines. And in particular, I want to point out that an important property of these objects here is that the ordering of the lines actually matters. Because now I've basically assigned a particular ordering in my Feynman diagram. And so it does matter whether you have 1, 2, 3, or 1, 3, 2 in the order of your of the amplitudes, how they appear here. This is one important difference between gravity and gauge theory. So these are the color stripped amplitudes. So we'll just compute those. So we've made our life now pretty simple. And now let me point out, let's think about QCD for a moment. So basically, as we're not going to specify the gauge group, we're not going to say it's SU3 or SU4 or whatever, because we've stripped the amplitudes of that. And so they're independent of that. But we'll only consider now for the moment amplitudes that only have gluons or only vector bosons. And one thing, one interesting property is if you only have if you have zero or one negative helicity gluon, then the amplitude vanishes identically. And the interesting thing is that this property follows from supersymmetry. And now you'll scream, hold on, QCD is not supersymmetric. That is true, but the tree amplitudes for gluons don't know that, because the tree amplitudes of a supersymmetric theory with gluons are the same as the ones that are that appear in a pure gluon theory, simply because the fermions and so on and so forth cannot appear at tree level. So you can use supersymmetric arguments to show that these amplitudes vanish identically. So the first thing that where we have something non-vanishing is when we actually have two negative helicity gluons. By the way, everything I'm saying, there's always a conjugate statement about only having two positive helicity gluons. So I mean, so similarly, amplitudes vanish where you only have one plus or only two or no pluses. Okay. No, this is a tree level statement. Sorry. Yeah. No, I'm going to restrict myself to tree level. So, I mean, in a supersymmetric theory, the SUSY statement holds independent of tree level. So if this is a true statement at any loop order for supersymmetric amplitudes. So maximally, so the first ones that appear, they are called the maximally helicity violating amplitudes, or MHV amplitudes. You might have heard that term before. And what is surprising is that they are given by a very simple formula, which is the following. If you have only a negative helicity gluon on line I and a negative helicity gluon on line J, then the amplitude is simply, in the numerator, you have this ij contraction to the fourth order. And in the denominator, you simply have this cyclic product of spin-up products. So 1, 2, 2, 3, and so on until you get cyclically back to n1. Now, this is, as long as you're looking at the statement for 4 or for 5 external lines, you can actually check this by hand and do the Feynman diagram calculation. But if you go to higher order, you'll have huge trouble confirming this. And you'll have to add lots and lots of diagrams until you find this very, very simple result. So this is one example where the final result is much more simple than the Feynman diagram calculation suggests. So this formula is known since the 90s, early 90s, I would say. Yes. But more elegant ways of proving this formula have been developed more recently. Good. And let me just to set up notation, so MHV amplitudes are the ones that have two negative helicity gluons. So if you have three negative helicity gluons, I'll call them next to MHV. And if you have four, I'll call them next to squared, basically n squared MHV and so on, and n cubed MHV and so on and so forth. That's just a setup. Are there any questions up for now? Okay. So now I'll talk about complex shifts, which is, as I indicated early on, we will take the external momenta to be complex to get some new insights. And the idea is the following. You take a number of the external lines. This can be simply two lines, or it can be more than two lines. And you make a complex shift on them. So you shift you take your original momentum, and then you take a complex number z and some momentum qi. But you want this shift so that the lines are still on shell. The external lines, the momenta may be complex, but you want them to be on shell. So you want them to be null. And you want to, of course, in your complete amplitude, conserve momentum. So the sum of all these qi has to be zero. And so the amplitude is then a function of z. And not all these lines may be shifted, but I've just put a hat on all the external lines. By hats, we'll denote shifted lines, or possibly shifted lines. Now we'll make a big assumption, and that is sort of a surprising assumption, which you would think, oh, that one is never going to work out. But we'll make the assumption that as we take z to infinity, the amplitude actually goes to zero. And you would actually think, oh, this assumption is going to get worse and worse if I look, instead of looking at scalar theories, if I look at gauge theory or even gravity, that it gets worse and worse and worse, because if you look at it from a Feynman diagram perspective, you have derivative interactions. And in principle, there's no reason why these derivatives shouldn't carry this external momentum that is shifted and goes to infinity. So you would, so in some sense, you're probing a certain UV limit of the amplitude, and you just think that with these derivatives, it's going to blow up. But actually, it turns out that in general, this amplitude, this assumption is easier to satisfy when you have gauge theory or gravity as opposed to simply scalars. Yes.
Infinity in some particular direction, or
no? This is so we are taking the momenta in a particular direction to infinity, but z doesn't. It doesn't matter like in what complex direction you go. It doesn't matter, but the direction of this this four momentum does matter. Yeah. Any other questions? OK, good. So now, under this assumption, let's just be naive and assume that it's satisfied. Then we can simply use Cauchy's theorem to actually compute the amplitude. So how do we do that? Well, we do this integral. Well, we take a contour that encircles all the poles. Now we have two different possibilities. One is we close the contour around infinity because of our assumption there's no pole at infinity, so we simply get zero. And on the other side, well, there's one obvious pole, which is simply z equals zero. And this pole, of course, simply gives us our amplitude. This is what we're looking for. But then there's going to be more poles. And how do these poles arise? Well, these poles, when you're shifting the momenta, if you think of it again in a Feynman diagram perspective, you can get a pole if an internal propagator becomes on shell, because then the propagator develops a pole. So whenever you choose whenever the shift is chosen in a way so that an internal line goes on shell, then the amplitude actually factorizes because the internal line is on shell. So you get a product of two different amplitudes, of two lower point and actually simpler amplitudes. So this is basically the statement. OK, now I've introduced some notation. But so by a diagram alpha, I just mean, so if you have one particular internal line that goes on shell, then by alpha, I'm just denoting all the external lines on one side. And by alpha bar, I'm just denoting all the lines on the other side. And so you get the sum over diagrams, sorry, where you have your propagator. But then you have these two amplitudes. But by this hat, I put a reminder that we don't just evaluate these amplitudes here naively, but at shifted external momenta, because we, after all, we have this shift in place. So these are on-shell amplitudes here that we can compute, but they are evaluated at complex momenta. And well, they are evaluated exactly at that value of z, of course, where this propagator goes on shell. So if our big assumption holds, we have found an expression that expresses our original amplitudes in terms of lower point amplitudes. Right. So it's implicit here and here and here and here. It's not implicit here. This is really the unshifted propagator. This is just comes out of the pole condition. So this doesn't diverge. This is simply your original propagator, but here in these shifted, in these hats, it's implicit. Yes.
It's a hat.
And any other questions? Good. So when can such a diagram contribute? Well, it's a very trivial thing, but let me point it out. A diagram can only contribute, obviously, if this 1 over p alpha squared has a pole when we shift it in z. And so that means that alpha has to contain at least one shifted line. Otherwise, by momentum conservation, it simply has to contain an internal line. Otherwise, this propagator doesn't shift it at all. And it cannot contain all shifted lines, because then p alpha again doesn't shift, because we have a momentum conservation imposed on the total shift, just to make this clear. And then naively, you'd think, well, in these factorizations, three-point amplitudes shouldn't occur, because three-point amplitudes should be vanishing by kinematics, simply because you think, well, if you try, you have two incoming massless particles and outcoming massless particle, but they would have to be collinear or something to get any non-vanishing result. This is not true in complex kinematics, and as our momenta are complex, we actually have to deal with three-point amplitudes. And so this is an example for, this is simply the formula that we saw earlier on for the three-point case, and this is in general non-vanishing. Good. So let's talk about the simplest type of shift that we can think of, is we simply shift two lines. And how do we write the shift? Well, now we go back to our bracket notation. That one is particularly convenient. I'll point that out in a second. So we shift, we take one line I, where we shift the corresponding square spinner. And then, but we leave the angle spinner invariant. And as you know from this, you can reconstruct the momentum. This is equivalent to shifting the momentum. And similarly, on the other line that I just called J, I'm shifting the angle spinner and leave the square spinner invariant. So why is this very convenient to write it? Well, it's convenient to write the shift this way, because automatically the shifted momentum is still going to be on shell. Just by construction, because the momentum is still going to be this type of a rank one matrix, and if it's a rank one matrix, its determinant vanishes, and we have an on-shell momentum. So this is how the two momenta shift, and momentum is also, if we shift them in this way, where J appears in the shift of I, and the other way around here, then a momentum is also manifestly conserved. And let me point out some interesting properties of this type of shift. That a kinematic analysis shows us that, so first of all, the type of diagrams are, of course, the ones that we get as I is on one amplitude and J is on the other, because we said, well, we have to split them between the two subamplitudes. And the left subamplitude that contains I is always going to vanish if it's anti-MHV, which means, so if it's three-point anti-MHV, which is basically saying that it's a plus-plus-minus amplitude if we are in QCD. And the right amplitude is going to be vanishing if it's a three-point MHV amplitude, so minus-minus-plus. This is just, and this property generalizes that whenever you have on one side, for example, here on the I side, you have the only square spinners shifted, then the amplitude is going to vanish if it's anti-MHV, three-point. And now let's play this game a little bit different. Let's do a three-line shift. There's another one that I want, one of the early shifts that I want to illustrate, is that you shift only square spinners this time, and three of them. And you shift them in this particular way, where you take an arbitrary reference spinner X that is at your choosing, and we choose these particular coefficients here in front of this reference spinner, which is going to satisfy ensure momentum conservation. Simply, if you calculate the change in the momentum, you'll find that exactly the Skalton identity pops up here, and the sum is zero, so the total shift in the momentum is zero. And as
just a confusion. You said at the beginning that any diagram that has only one of the only one spin that's opposite, one helicity that's opposite, right, of the others, or has all the same helicity is zero. Wouldn't that always make all the three?
Exactly. So this argument, what I haven't told you is that it breaks down for three lines. It holds for four or more lines. For three lines, there's an exception that's that has something to do with when you try to use supersymmetric water entities to derive this, that certain that you basically get 0 equals 0 instead of the identity that you're seeking for. That's simply because, because of the special kinematics of the free line shift. Any other questions? Good. So let me talk about, now that I've given you an idea on these on-shell methods and about these recursion relations that help you express. Hold on, maybe I didn't mention the last thing. Yeah, so as I told you before, when you shift square spinners, then no anti-MHV 3-point supplications appear. And this is actually a very nice property of this three-line shift, that you only get MHV and MHV and so on, M square MHV and so on in the sub-amplitudes. You don't get any anti-MHV 3-point. Good. So now that I've introduced on-shell methods for you and showed how you can derive from a complex shift, you can derive recursion relations to recursively express a complicated amplitudes in terms of simpler sub-amplitudes. Let me show you one particular application, which is the MHV vertex expansion. And I'm going to talk about n equals 4 super Young Mills. And Yuji has talked a little bit about that, but let me just review this from a little bit of a different perspective. What is the particle content of this theory? So we have one positive helicity gluon, and the corresponding operator for particle I, I'm just going to denote by A of I, where I just denotes the particle as we did before. Then four positive helicity gluinos. This, again, I'm going to denote this by the letter A, but then I'll have an index A also on the operator, which is simply the SU4 index of the n equals 4 of the n equals 4 super Young Mills. And then we have scalars, which simply carry two of these indices, but it's antisymmetric. So in this notation, I've expressed all operators completely as carrying only upper indices, which is basically they are only as antisymmetric products of the 4 and not of the 4 bar of SU4. This is very convenient for what we're going to do. And then simply we have, similarly, we have negative helicity gluons and the antiparticle here corresponding to the negative helicity gluon, which gluinos and gluons, which carry all four indices. Any questions about the particle content? So Yuji denoted this one by A earlier on, and this one, this here by psi, and this by phi, just to make the connection. So MHV amplitudes, well, so what are the MHV amplitudes in this theory? What does it even mean, an MHV amplitude? Early on, I defined this in terms of negative helicity gluons. Well, so they are simply all amplitudes that are related by supersymmetry to these pure gluon amplitudes. And in this notation, one can see actually sort of a structure emerging if we again write the pure gluon amplitude that I've written before. So here are minus, minus, plus, plus, plus. And this 1, 2, now you can sort of see as, OK, we have four indices here and four indices here. So there's a contraction between 1 and 2, and this appears to the fourth power. So you might guess some interpretation here. And actually, this is exactly what happens in the other MHV amplitudes. Let's look at a more complicated amplitude. This one is also MHV, which I can simply see by counting the number of SU4 indices. If there's a total of 8 SU4 indices, it's an MHV amplitude. And to calculate it, instead of contracting the two negative helicity gluons, which I don't have anymore, I'm simply looking, OK, this is index 1. Where else does it appear? It appears here. So I'm contracting 1 and 5. And so 2 and 4 are appearing here and here. So, but they share two indices, the index 2 and the index 3. So I have 2, 4 squared, and so on, and 4, 5 for the index. So this is up to a sign how you can easily calculate the MHV amplitudes in n equals 4 super Young Mills. And now let me give you the prescription for the MHV vertex expansion. And I'll just illustrate this for next to the MHV amplitudes. The idea is that you take your amplitude, your endpoint amplitude, and you write down all possible basically like this factorized diagrams where each vertex is an MHV subamplitude. So that means here the external lines are still these lines from 1 to n. And now they are split up in this way so that each of these is an MHV vertex diagram. And for example, for n to the third MHV, there are two different types of diagrams that contribute. And now the claim is that when you add these, all these different ways of writing diagrams of this form, and then you compute these MHV vertex diagrams here, that you exactly get your tree level amplitude. Now, this is a very non-trivial statement, and it's not at all clear here from the outset why this should be the case. And there's one more thing that you may wonder. Hold on, these internal lines are not on shell. So if I use this formula that I showed earlier on, I sort of assumed that all the external lines are on shell. This was an on-shell amplitude formula. So what am I supposed to do with these internal lines? And there's a prescription, the so-called CSW prescription, which basically says that whenever you encounter in your MHV, when you're trying to compute any of these MHV vertices, these sub-amplitudes, that you replace the spinner P alpha simply by P alpha acting on an arbitrary reference spinner X. So now you might already see some connection. Hold on, there were these certain shifts where I had to pick an arbitrary reference spinner. And here, to calculate the MHV vertex expansion, I also have to pick an arbitrary reference spinner. And indeed, one can be derived from the other. They are intimately connected. And let me point out that, of course, once you sum overall amplitude all of these diagrams, you have to the result has to be independent of X. After all, it's arbitrary. And that's an important check when you calculate an amplitude that your sum is, again, independent of this chosen X. Any questions about that? OK, good. So the MHV vertex expansion allows an efficient computation of tree amplitudes. And it was proven a while ago for gauge theory by Risaga. But for example, if you try to do the same thing for gravity, you run into trouble. So we know that the MHV vertex expansion is not valid for all gravity amplitudes, tree level amplitudes. That's the, yeah.
Yes. Where's the dynamics in it? If I perturb a little bit away from angle 4, by just adding some either relevant or irrelevant deformation, okay, these formulas will still be valid? They rely on the dynamics.
This formula here relies heavily on supersymmetry. So if you perturb by something that's not supersymmetry, you'll not have this formula. So this is really, I mean. And the other thing that I want to mention, this is really at the origin of moduli space in Higgs 4. So if you're going some Higgs branch or something, this is not going to be valid. This is different from n equals 8 supergravity, where you connect, where when you go along the moduli space, you're recovering the same perturbative theory if you express it in the right variables. It's not the case for anything. Good. So now, for n equals 4 super Young Mills, you have scalars and fermions. And actually, as I told you, this makes things using recursion relations harder to prove, because actually the large C behavior when you use some recursion relation to try to prove something is worse when you have scalars and fermions. But it seems like supersymmetry should help us a little bit there, and indeed it does. And another thing is that I want to point out that for generic amplitudes, the MHV vertex expansion is more powerful in n equals 4 super Young Mills than even for pure gauge theory. And the reason is that a lot more of these diagrams are actually going to vanish identically. So you have to sum a lot less diagrams to recover the full amplitude. And that's nice, because that's sort of the general theme that when you use on-shell methods and you have more symmetry, more supersymmetry, that amplitude computations become easier and not more difficult. So this is one manifestation of this phenomenon. So how do we prove it? And the idea is the following. We're not going to shift 2. We're not going to shift 3 lines. We're simply going to shift all lines. So I is now not one particular line, but each line I we're going to shift. And each one has its own coefficient ci. We're going to impose momentum conservation. And the claim that I have here is that under such an all-line shift, an n equals 4 super Young Mills amplitude at level n to the k MHV falls off at least as 1 over z to the k. this is nice because, I mean, we don't want to prove the MHV vertex expansion for MHV amplitudes. We know, I mean, for MHV amplitudes it's trivially valid. But once we get to a higher k level, that's where we want to prove it. And then we have a fall off, so we can derive a recursion relation from these all-line shifts. So then we're going to use the all-line shift recursion relation to derive the MHV vertex expansion. Now, I'm only going to illustrate this part. This part is a little technical, and I know you all want to get to lunch. So I will focus on this part, but let me make one comment on this part. And that is, when you have a larger fall off, usually that means that your recursion relation is less powerful. Now, why is that? That is because when you have a good large C fall off, that means there is certain relations between the diagrams in your expansion. And you can see that because you can basically, originally we derived our recursion relation from doing this, dz over z of a of z. But when you have a good large C fall off, you can also go to, let's say, z to the zero or z to the c squared or z to the third. And all this is going to give you relations between diagrams. So it seems like actually maybe the MHV vertex expansion is not that powerful if you go to larger k. But that's not true. Well, it's not completely true. And that is because at each level k, we don't just take the recursion relation, but we combine diagrams in the recursion relation in a nice way so that the MHV vertex expansion comes out. And at level k, we need to combine k diagrams before we get the MHV vertex expansion. So that will so we are actually using some of these interrelations between diagrams to simplify. Good. But let me just only focus on this part. So how do we do this? We want to. How many minutes do I have? I know I started late, but
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, no problem. Sorry to keep on. Okay, good. So let's do the trivial part. Well, for k equals zero, we want to show that it goes as 1 over z to the k. But well, I showed you that MHV amplitudes are simply functions of these angle spinners, and the square spinners do not even appear. So if we shift the square spinners, of course, the amplitude is not going to feel it. So it's going to trivially go as order 1, which is 1 over z to the k for k equals 0. So let's do the second almost trivial case, which are anti-MHV amplitudes. Anti-MHV are basically amplitudes which have all positive Felicity gluons except for 2. So this is the conjugate case of the MHV amplitudes. And for those, basically the relation between k and n is this one. And these only depend on square brackets now. In this way, this is just the conjugate of the formula I showed you early on. Now, these square brackets do shift. Under the shift, they all go as order z. And but you have 4 square brackets in the numerator and n in the denominator. And with this relation, you simply get 1 over z to the k. And you have also trivially shown this result. So now let's look at all other amplitudes. And now we need to show this for all other amplitudes. We need to do a trick. And the first thing is we're looking at a different representation of the amplitude. And that is we do a BCFW shift, which was this two-line shift I talked about earlier on. So we do a two-line shift expansion of this amplitude. So you're wondering, OK, so how do I know that this two-line shift expansion is valid? So that has been proven that all amplitudes in n equals 4 super Young Mills have a valid two-line shift if you pick the two lines appropriately. And I also want to point out at this stage that there is a more supersymmetric generalization of these BCFW shifts, which we call them super shifts, for which actually any two-line shift is valid. But that's not what we're going to use here. So we're going to use this one. And there's one exception, that one, which is the 4 scalar amplitude, which is simply a constant. That one, of course, does not have a valid BCFW expansion, but it is an MHV amplitude, so we don't care anyway. So we use such a valid representation. And then on this representation, which is a sum over BCFW diagrams, we act with the all-line shift. So we do a secondary shift in some sense. And something that seems trivial, but it actually takes a little bit of algebra to work it out, is that the all-line shift on the entire amplitude acts as an all-line shift on the sub-amplitudes. And the reason why this is slightly non-trivial is because I told you before that sub-amplitudes are evaluated at shifted momenta. So you things are a little bit screwed up, and you have to extract the leading behavior carefully, and you'll find out that indeed the all-line shift acts on, as an all-line shift on the sub-amplitudes. And then, well, then you know what to do. You just do this thing recursively, because assume, so these sub-amplitudes have less external legs. Now let's just assume that our statement of 1 over z to the k fall off holds for these two sub-amplitudes, which have less external legs. Then we can simply say, OK, we have 1 over z to the k1, if this is an n to the k1 MHV amplitude. And we have 1 over z to the k2 for this right-hand side. And then we get 1 over z from the shifting of the propagator. The propagator definitely shifts, because all lines shift. So in particular, this internal propagator has to shift. So in total, we get 1 over z to the k falloff. And this is how we can prove this whole thing recursively. Let me just show you how to build it up. So MHV, so here in this diagram, these dots represent sectors of amplitudes where the n to the k MHV level is indicated in this direction. The number of external lines is indicated in this direction. And the trivial case that I showed you early on was MHV and anti-MHV, where we know this statement. And then when we use the BCFW expansion, let's say for this, for an amplitude in this class, then it's going to be expressed in terms of sub-amplitudes that are below or to the left in this diagram, below and or to the left. So you can start here, and you can easily, and then you work your way up, and you can show it for all amplitudes in the theory. So this shows that all line shift recursion relations, all line shift recursion relations are valid, and that we can use it to derive the MHV vertex expansion, which I'm the second step I'm not going to carry out now. So let me just, actually, in the interest of time, let me skip this slide here, which is some applications of the MHV vertex expansion. You can ask me about it later if you're interested. Let me just conclude and say that on-shell methods are hoped to have convinced you that they are very crucial to compute tree and loop amplitudes and very efficient, and that they are applicable in a wide range of physics, starting from very applied things from an LHC background to studying the finiteness of n equals 8 supergravity, then I've hopefully also convinced you that the MHV vertex expansion is a very compact way of and efficient way of computing amplitudes in n equals 4. I want to emphasize an alternative that is very interesting, which Drummond and Hand and collaborators have found an expression of tree level amplitudes in n equals 4 super young Mills in terms of superconformal invariants, which I don't know about the efficiency of that method, but it's definitely conceptually very interesting because of this superconformal symmetry. There's a dual missing here, dual superconformal invariants. You can ask me about the symmetry afterwards if you're interested what that is at all. And it would be interesting to generalize these methods to n equals 8 supergravity. And actually, these shifts that I've talked about may show a way of finding via KLT, using these KLT relations to find recursion relations for supergravity amplitudes. And once you use KLT to prove their validity, you can stay within supergravity, and you don't have to go back to n equals 4 super young Mills to compute amplitudes. So this might show a nice way of computing n equals 8 supergravity amplitudes. Let me stop here. Thank you.
So you said it wasn't valid for gravity. Did you mean not proven, or is there a counter example? If the method of proof fails, or is there actually a
so when you do this naively in gravity, you find that the amplitude that you calculate is x dependent. So that's a clear counter example, because then it may be true for.
So what level do you find
next? It depends on your external states a little bit, but at NMHV level, when you go up to let's say 12 external legs and higher, you run into trouble. And that's expected, because the more external legs you have, the more derivative vertices you have, and the worse the large C behavior is going to be. So that is, seems to fail for gravity. But I want to point out that there's, again, a supersymmetric extension of the BCFW shift, which works actually for n equals 8 supergravity. But this does not give the MHV vertex expansion. It gives a different expansion.
Great. Let's start.